Joining me today is professional jazz musician Gilad Osman. He's the author of The Wandering Who, among other books, and a philosopher. He did a talk recently in the United States about the cognitive elite, and we're going to discuss that today, racial politics, identity politics, what happened to the left, why are they so obsessed with biological categories, why does dissent have to go through the Azza filter, and is patriotism a solution?
We'll do it live!
You are listening to the AMC Report with your host, Ryan Dawson.
Very interested in the talk you gave about the cognitive elite and also focusing on what happened to the left, what they used to be compared to what they are now.
I think that it is a pretty simple because many of us, I would say, I would love to say all of us, been leftists at a certain stage, and many of us, I would say most of us, started to gather at a certain stage that there is a kind of an inherent fraudulent mode that is something that is consistent to all those that is apparent in all the different lefty discourses we scrutinize, you know, especially Jewish. Whenever you look into Noam Chomsky, who is so much against borders, but then when it comes to the Israeli state, he is against borders, he's against state, but he's for the Jewish state. Then you see the...
But Noam Chomsky gave support to Pol Pot, so he's out
know,
in my book.
For sure, you know, numerous discrepancies and contradictions. You see Max Bloom's interview with David Irving, which is uniquely pathetic now after... Israeli paper admitted that the Ynet, you know, the biggest paper in Israel, that they've never seen a real gas chamber. You know, they just admitted it 2 weeks ago, and they hope that the one in Sobibor will be a real one. You know, and then he suddenly becomes a supporter of the Palestinians, and yet. Try to impose all those measures on freedom of speech. There is something uniquely dishonest in the entire left discourse. The most apparent thing is that leftists support nationalist movement all over the world and very far from home, but somehow they never support the nationalist at home. Mm-hmm. You know, so English, British supporters of Palestine, and they would be.
I think what's going on there is the left today, they used to think, they used to be all about labor, but now they're just.
Exactly.
And they're obsessed with race and sex and categories.
Yeah, we'll get into it. So,
yeah.
The issue. Is very simple, and I explored in New York in this talk. It is so simple, you know. To start with, the most fundamental observation is, as you said, as I said in New York, as many people realize, left was initially the voice of the worker. Once we drifted away from manufacturing. From production, left became a set of empty signifiers because there is no the people who used workers or working class are now workless class reduced into underclass, and the left has become a pretty much a set of controlled opposition, and this is very, very easy to explain. And I believe that with my cognitive elite model, by the way, I borrowed this cognitive, I'm not that, this cognitive model from Richard Ehrenstein, who actually wrote an incredible book, probably the big achievement in terms of the social science in America. And why? Because he produced a prediction, a reading of American society being divided not on labor, but being divided on base of cognitive ability. And he argued, he predicted that within 10 or 20 years, this divide within American society would evolve into a physical divide. Now, everybody that speaks about segregation, the segregation is not ethnic. It is as well ethnic, but it is largely a cognitive segregation. If you are a black woman of a Jewish descent, converted into Islam, and so on and so on, but you have 170 IQ, and you're the best programmer in the Bay Area, you will get a job in Google or Apple. It is not an ethnic, it's not race. They maintain those categories because the left is embedded with ethnic and racial thinking. And why? Because the left has become, or maybe always been, the voice of the Jews. And this is very easy to explain. Both left.
Well, it's interesting also with that bell curve book you're talking about. Nobody really got upset with him saying Asians and Jews have a higher average IQ. But yeah, they got really pissed off when they said blacks and Latinos have a lower average IQ.
Exactly. And why? And why? Because the people who were upset with him were themselves the Jews. So they probably, also maybe more than certainly, wanted to generate this sensation of support for those the oppressed. But in fact, they have been sealing their domination already then. You know, American people can be always concerned with wars and segregation, and we see beautiful Jews in Manhattan supporting the Palestinians, impressed with it. But I must admit that I'm kind of 50 years old now. I'm visiting America, the state, for 25 years, 26 years. When I visited New York in the 80s, Manhattan was a very poor city. There was a lot of poverty. I'm a jazz player. I'm a jazz musician. There were a lot of black people in downtown Manhattan. It was still a vibrant, mixed society. You go now and visit Manhattan, it is white, rich, and Jewy. The ethnic cleansing happened in America. It is more than likely that within 10 or 15 years, we will see a Palestinian minister in the Israeli government. But we won't see a goy, a Gentile, and treasury in JVP in Manhattan, because those Jews have picked the Palestinian solidarity is a project that divert the attention from the ethnic cleansing they are operating in the midst of America. So Palestine has become a diversion, and this definitely explains why nothing happens in Palestine. And now we go one step farther in order to understand what is going on here. The cognitive elite, the people who are dominating our society, they are, in most cases, 2014, very liberal people. They believe in equality. They believe in immigration. They believe in they are opposing any form of racism, and it's all beautiful. They support LGBT, good for them, and everything. Now, the left traditionally was there to destruct, to criticize, to present dissent to the elite. But shockingly enough, the left believes exactly in the same things. They believe in equality, they support LGBT, they support immigration. And what we see now is that the left, instead of opposing the elite, it ends up in a conflict, in a clear conflict with the working class or with the working class. And it is supported by the elite. And if you want to be precise, it is actually supported largely by people like George Soros and the Open Society Institute that support every progressive left organization around the world. So the left, from being the voice of the workers, become a control opposition apparatus. And the meaning of it is that millions, billions, I don't know, many millions of Americans, many millions of Westerns are left without political voice, which is exactly what we see.
Yeah, you see all this energy focused on what I call paternalistic style racism and categories of just nothing type of issues, and not talking about labor and not talking about policies or anything that would actually affect the standard of living and help someone's life. They just are splitting hairs about gender issues and things like that, which actually fosters racism, because when you start cutting people into all these asses, as you say, and trying to give special rights, it pisses off all the other groups.
What the left did, and this is the work of the Frankfurt School, they realized at a certain stage that, and by the way, Gramsci understood it very early on in the first 20 years of the 20th century. Frankfurt School were quick to follow. Wilhelm Reich understood it in the 40s. They realized that they cannot and they will never be able to bond with the working class. Within the left, there is a clear animosity to working class, and the reason is very simple, because working class never went for the revolution. They never stood up for the labor ideology, and it is very easy to explain. Say in many of my talks, the flag gives you much more. With the flag, with the American flag, you know, identifying with the American flag means that it was you who landed on the moon. It was you who won Germany on the beaches of Normandy in D-Day. It was you who dropped an atomic bomb. It locates you, the one, the person, the nationalist subject at the heart of law. Of past. The left has nothing to offer or to compete with it. What they give you, a banner to march in front of a factory that loses money and you try to grab whatever is left? No, it's not going to work. And the left then decided to divide society into marginal categories, or what we call to develop identity politics. So instead of following the traditional lefty philosophy that made a lot of sense, that suggested that it doesn't matter if you are a man or a woman, a black or a Jew or whatever, or gay. The only thing that matters is your role within society. The left adopted this approach of identity politics. They taught us how to start to talk as a Jew, as a woman, as a gay, as a lesbian, as a black. What they did, they cut society into very many margins, and we started to engage, as you just mentioned, in sectarian wars to fight the gays fighting with the Muslims, the black fighting with the Hispanics, the Jews fighting with everyone. And all that time, manufacturing was kicked out of the window. Big companies moved in, globalization moved in. Now, there is something very crucial to understand.
See, this is why I always advocate just unifying against the redheads. It's a joke.
Again, and
can we just rally behind that cause?
No, but the issue is here. It's about time now to understand that if the left is cosmopolitan by metaphysically, it is cosmopolitan, not that different from the globalized market ideology. Because the only thing that opposes globalized market is localism, is patriotism. I stood up in Rome in front of quite a big crowd, and I spoke for 1 hour, 20 minutes, explaining this model of cognitive elite. And I then told him, listen, this is the situation now. We have elite, you know. Even people who supported the occupation movement, it's not 1% and 99%. It's not 1% with money and 9% improved. It's 1% of people who are very uniquely intelligent and 99% who are pushed out and are becoming working class. Many of them are already a workless class, underclass, because they are not clever enough. I ask a very simple question. I asked there in Rome, how do we establish a new bond between those clever people and the rest of us? This is a very crucial question. Now, check it out. This was hilarious. There was a guy there from the United Nations. I realized later that he was from the United Nations. He kind of half-joking said, oh, it's very simple. All we have to do is a mass genocide of different people. There was another woman who was American, a lady who was giving a talk about a matriarchal society, and in the most typical lefty manner, she said, oh, it is very simple. All we have to do is to make sure that the patriarchal society is abolished, and so on. And I said, you know, it's quite amazing. Here I am sitting, you know, standing in front of a crowd of 100 people speaking about a problem that we have to engage with, and then left the audience as a chance to react. One is saying, let's kill the clever people. Then there is this woman who is saying, let's kill the men. And I didn't ask you to kill anyone. It is
nobody said marry into it. No.
You know, it's quite amazing that when leftists confront a problem, the first that they want to do is to kill someone. Now, I think that the solution is quite simple. It's very simple. The solution has something to do with the presentation of a new grand narrative that bonds the poor and the rich. It is very simple. Now, what such a grand narrative could be, you know? Now, this is becoming very embarrassing because I say, patriotism. I told these people in Italy, you know, be patriotic. Buy Fiat. Buy Alfa Romeo. They told me, listen, it's not a problem, but Fiat and Alfa Romeo are not produced in Poland. You know? Mm-hmm. I'm telling Americans, make sure that you make cars. Make sure that you buy your own cars. If somebody wants to buy Toyota, it's not a problem. But custom tax, you make sure that it costs four or five times more. So if American cars are not as good at the moment, you know, you will produce a lot of them. You will not only learn how to make them good. You know, start to be patriotic. And as well, also, you must be nationalist. So instead of the EU, which George Soros is so concerned, 30% of the Europeans are not happy with it. Let me tell you, you know, in the next election, you will find out that it is 90%.
See, I have another take on this. I don't think they're clever. I don't think there's anything superior or intelligent about counterfeiting money or hiring each other based on pure nepotism. I mean, I don't think there are any billionaires without the state. And the main problem is utilizing government to prop up these cartels. And there's nothing elite about them. They're just the people in bed with government.
I don't think that you're right. It's very simple. You know, it takes you five years in the world, age of five, you realize that some people are faster than you when they are running. Some boys look better than you. You look better than others.
Yeah, absolutely. But I don't think intelligence correlates to getting money.
No. And some people, and then you get to the age of 18, and you realize that some people are superior academically. And then you get to the age of 25, and you realize that some people are very clever in making money. Now, the cognitive elite are not just people who are making money. Some of them are not rich at all. Some of them programmers in IT people in producing algorithms. Some of them know how to translate their brilliance into money. And by the way, some of them are also criminals who are very clever. You know, it is a completely new way to look at society. You know, and by the way, when I speak to Americans, it is very interesting because I hear a lot, you know, people tell me, you know, it is a lot to do with education. One of the most interesting differences between America and, let's say, the Jewish ghetto 18th century is that in the ghetto, they made sure that they sent top rabbis to the most remote cheders. Cheders are kind of the small room where the Jewish kids used to gather and to learn from the rabbis. So they would send back rabbis from Germany to all those places in the East to make sure that they try to find the talent. They were tracing the talent and they were looking after the talent. I'm not so sure that America is sending its best teachers and professors to trace talent in Detroit or neighborhoods of poverty in Oakland and New Jersey. And I think that I'm right here. So, you know, I don't see any problem in meritocracy. What is meritocracy? Meritocracy means, the way I see it, is that you make sure that you put the right people in the right positions. You know, I really want to make sure that the person who make decisions on British security and foreign affairs is the most clever person in this country. At the moment, this is not the case. At the moment, it doesn't matter who is the person that is making the decision for Britain, because it's actually the Jewish lobby that makes this decision. And the Jewish lobby is definitely not a collection of people who understand this subject matter.
And the U.S. has the reverse policy in its obsession with equality. They end up going with the lowest common denominator and holding back people who could excel.
Exactly. So they did in America, and this is exactly what Ehrenstein figured out in 94. He says, you know, there is no doubt that Ehrenstein, whether I agree with him or not, was a liberal and a capitalist and a classic one. He said, society needs to develop at the most, to invest in its most talented people, rather than making all the idiots feel average, or to give them academic degrees that was nothing. And this is what we do. There is an industry of academia that is there selling the imaginary, phantasmic image of cleverness by the age of 22 $200,000 to an idiotic bank, and you have a paper that was nothing. And this is with the hope, by the age of 24, 25, that you didn't find, after not finding a single job, even with a PhD in gender studies, you may start to gather that you and then there is no future for you at all. Now, a country, a good, clever country, doesn't need more 5, 6 very, very, very good universities that pick most clever people. But then you have to make sure that every person in this country who is clever enough is the most advanced education. And this is exactly something that we don't have in Britain. We don't have in America. I see what my kids are studying in British school. You know, it makes me furious. It is embarrassing.
That's why Japan's a better bet.
Is Japan better?
Well, the system is like, they're not selling diplomas like they do in the U.S. Everyone is trying to get into Tokyo or Kyoto, and it's very regimented. I mean, you got to know your role after high school. And
My daughter studied in Japan, and if I understood it correctly, the high schools are actually very, very good. The universities are much less interesting.
Right, the high school, you have to compete to get into a high school. And what they do is they study so hard to get into a university, but after that, a lot of them just horse around once they're in college, but they study really hard before that, sort of the reversal.
Yeah, it is very interesting. I think that the situation now is pretty grave, because as this is something that Ehrenstein actually predicted. Ehrenstein argued back again in 94 that unlike, let's say, British aristocracy, that was largely committed to the patriotic idiom. You know, I wouldn't say that every aristocrat was, but you know, it's not a secret that they were the first to die in the war. They were, they were on their horses, they were riding, towards those German machine guns. And basically were eradicated. They were the first to volunteer to every expedition, and they died for the flag. That's what they were trained to do. Unlike kind of aristocracy or was aristocracy in America, that for the future of America as a collective, in a collective, as part of the all, collective culture, the current cognitive elite that is the new aristocracy adopted the manner of thinking of Latin American elite, which is only concerned in the in developing the its own interest as a class. And this is why I think that the Lower Manhattan is exactly where you see it. It is a posh, white, you know, they to buy out their segregation, and then instead of criticizing it. Instead of criticizing it, we give all the minorities that are pushed out this identity politic, the term, oh, speak as a black, as Hispanic, as blah, 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 as a Jew, as an Arab, as a Muslim, and so on and so on. Now, there is something that I didn't speak about in the talk in America. There is something that is very, very crucial for the understanding of modern society and the left discourse in the greatest form of treason by dividing society into identities. We teach people to speak as Palestinians, as black, as Hispanics, as gays, as lesbians, as transvestites, I don't, whatever. Each identity is defined by an oppressor. So for the Jew, it is the anti-Semite. For the Israeli, for the Palestinian, it is, you know, we call it the Zionist, but it's really the Jew. For the gay, it is the homophobe. For the black, it is the white supremacist. The left discourse creates this binary opposition between the oppressed and the oppressor. Each identity is defined by an oppressor. But this is a total disaster, because what we actually plant a paralysis at the center of the identity political discourse. The black would tell you, see, it's not my fault. I'm oppressed. It is the white supremacist. The Palestinians adopt it and they start to say, oh, it's not my problem. You see, it's the Zionists or the Jews. You know, for the gays, it is the homophobe. What we did, we created a multi-society divided into multiple identities, and each of them is power. Who are the only people who are not paralyzed by identity politics? The Jews. And why? Because they're doing it for 3,000 years. They know all the tricks. The Jews have both. They cry about anti-Semitism, and all the time they make Gaza into a prison camp. They cry about anti-Semitism. The good Jews in Manhattan cry about anti-Semitism, and all the time they're very quiet about Manhattan being engaged in it, New York City, engaged in ethnic cleansing of the black community. And by the way, they do exactly the same thing in Harlem. Harlem, you know, block after block after block is clean, is of black people, and it is rich people who come instead. Am I right?
Yeah, it's segregation through money.
and the segregation, and then without segregation, but at the end of the day, it is us adopting segregation. If I call myself, when I start to talk as a Jew or as a Muslim or as a gay, I lock myself in the ghetto. It is self-imposed. Jews always cry about themselves being thrown into ghettos, and I always wrote about it and said, no, they want to live in ghettos. Look at Israel. Israel surrounded itself voluntarily by the most devastating, huge, humongous ghetto walls. It was their choice. The Jews wanted to live in ghetto. It is self-segregation. I really advise every black American, gay American, Jewish American, Muslim, stop talking as a and be American. This is the only way forward. Be American. Buy American cars. To your own American jazz music. And I have the same advice to Italians and to French and to British. And this form of true patriotism is respectful to other people. To be a true nationalist is to respect other people nationalists. This is exactly what we miss in Zionism. Zionism is a hardcore nationalist movement that doesn't respect any other nationalist movement. We have the Jews in the left, including Noam Chomsky, despising every form of nationalism, but when it comes to the one state to two states, you know, Chomsky and this Jewish leftist always support two states because they have respect for Jewish nation. You know, enough. This fraudulent culture, this deceitful ideology must be exposed and shunned once and for all.
I guess there's a big fear of nationalism, especially in Europe, because they associate that with the causes of the Second World War.
By the way, I totally understand it. And one of the things that people have to understand, one of the things that people must understand, is that the problem that happened with Hitlerism, I don't even want to say Nazism, was that it was a copy of Zionist philosophy. Not the early Zionists, but the later, you know, the Zionists. Hitler adopted a Judeo-centric philosophy that is ratio-centric. An expansionist, exactly like Zionism. The idea, you know, he's quite a horrible guy, Jonah Goldberg, but he actually wrote a very good book on fascism, as long as you remember that he's a horrible guy and you are read it, you are very careful the way you read it, you can learn a lot from this book. And he makes a differentiation between fascism, national socialism, and Hitlerism. Fascism is the idea of social justice within a state. So you are basically a socialist, but not a cosmopolitan. You believe the Italian people, for instance, should live in a society that is driven by the notion of justice and equality. This is a beautiful idea, and what Goldberg is doing actually in this book, it shows that the American progressive school of thought actually believes exactly in the same thing, and I think that he is largely correct. Then National Socialism is specifically the belief that in social justice within the borders of the German state. Hitlerism is social justice within the context of superior race. Now, when you go along with Goldberg definition, there is no problem with fascism the way he defines it. Yes, there is no problem with National Socialism. Is it really a problem if America finds its way to create a society that a non-interventionist yet extreme and with social I think that this is the best thing that could happen to America. The problem starts where you start to adopt the notion of race, that I am born into a born exceptionally different. This is the problem, and I tell you that the people in his follow this philosophy, but also the great Jewish leftist in New York who follow exactly the same philosophy. They create peace movement that is open to people who are racially divided. So for instance, you, Ryan, is not qualified to become the secretary of Jews' Voice for Peace. You're not racially qualified. You're all right? So, you know, I would be very suspicious, you know. You are not as qualified as Max Blumenthal.
And yet, if another race did the same thing, the White Voice for Peace or something, that would get shouted down immediately because it would be seen as racist and superior, inferior type of thing.
Not only that they don't qualify, they don't allow, they have a racially, you know, and this make it very clear, Jews are obviously not a race, but their political ideology is a race born. Yeah, not only that they don't allow goyim in. Going Gentiles, yeah. Right. They don't even allow the discussion of their racist ideology. So if you look at Mondo Wise comment policy, the two, three years ago, they changed it and they ruled out the possibility to criticize Israel's Jewishness. So Israel defines itself as the Jewish state. They repeat it every possible occasion, yet we are not entitled to discuss it. And this is exactly
you
the
can
meaning.
You can get a free flight to Israel based on your ethnicity.
Exactly. Exactly.
And, but it's not a Jewish state, of course.
And this is exactly how I define Jewish power. Jewish power is the capacity to silence the discussion on Jewish power. This is why Jewish power is not AIPAC. AIPAC is just one symptom of Jewish power. Jewish power is not flat. Sajaiya or Rafa in Gaza. No. These are vile symptoms of Jewish barbarism. Jewish power is the capacity to silence the discussion. Very clever tactics. Now, let me show you how it works. So you start to understand that these people, at least a few of them, are extremely clever. If I tell you, listen, I'm a Jew, let me handle it. I'm a Jew, I can talk about it. And I take care of the criticism of Israel, you are left out. And why? Because you're not racially qualified. But the Israelis are even, and by the way, this is what the JBPs are doing, the Max Blumenthal. And let me talk, I will deal with it. Leave it with me. By the way, this is the reason why on in a very early stage, I myself denounced my connection to the tribe. And by the way, this is why I was subject to so much harassment. Because the worst thing that they cannot stand, they cannot accept, and if they have the facilities, you know, they just need to the wood, is people saying, I'm not a Jew anymore. They don't like it at all. Because this is an amount of freedom that allows you, that removes you from that prohibition. Now, let's look at a very sophisticated...
Well, that's before you get into that, it's a good ploy, because basically saying that people have abandoned their patriotism in order to cling to their little subcategory, which are based on biology and just nonsense. And yet the Jewish category, which is racial yet not racial, its patriotism is one and the same,
racist,
because they have a racial
racist,
state.
But not their biological.
Right.
I think this is, yeah, you're right. Yeah, listen, this is very, very clever, but there was something that they didn't get, I don't think that many people really spoke about it. You remember that there was this unit A200 in Israel, the intelligence unit, that, you know, I don't know, 40 or 50 members of this unit said, we don't want to be part of this campaign anymore, and so on and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember it? It happened 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Basically, numerous Israeli intelligence officers and soldiers said this was after the Gaza operation, where Israel committed some horrendous war crimes. And then suddenly, a bunch of Israel stood up and said, no, we are refusing. We don't want to do this anymore. The reaction was immediate. So the entire Western press on their knees praising the Israelis and the Jews and say, oh, it is so nice. Look at it. You know, it's an open society. And everyone, until the revelation about this unit, you know, everybody was ready to take the Israelis to the egg, and suddenly there was a lot of forgiving in there. And in fact, nobody speaks about the egg anymore. This is uniquely clever approach. Now, let's look for a second a Jewish humor. Showed in the talk in Manhattan, Jewish humor is a very role in bridging, for instance, the cognitive within the Jewish society, and dealing with the Jewish underclass dealing with its own problem, and so on and so on and so on.
Bridge the stupid and the smart through humor.
Through humor. This is shown in New York. I think that it's a very interesting. And actually, I took some of it from Shlomo Zand, opened my eyes to the fact that there is no such a thing as Jewish humor. It's actually Yiddish humor. It's the humor of the Jewish underclass. And the old Jewish humor, 19th century, the Jews just made themselves look, they're always ahead of the goy, they're always more clever, they're always on top of the game. But at the same time, they were the most oppressed people. So through humor, they presented themselves witty, like their brothers and sisters who left them long time ago and moved to live in the West. So it's the bond, Jewish humor, facilitates the unification between the East, the old student, the East Jew, and the Western Jew, the Rothschild, the Einstein, and so on and so on.
Of the West, yeah.
Jewish contemporary Jewish humor is very, very different. Look at Sarah Silverman, I Will Kill Jesus Again. Look at Woody Allen, the clumsy, uniquely ugly Jew who owns his symptoms. Look at Larry David, by the way, I like Larry David a lot, Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's hard to watch, the Jewish supremacy, the Jewish exceptionalism, it's all about that. They're celebrating the most, the ugliest Jewish stereotype. And what it is all about, they own their symptoms. If you tell me, Gilad, you're such a horrible, nice, self-centered, horrible human being. And I tell you, okay, Ryan, can you tell me something I don't know? Right. I dismantle. I dismantle your criticism, And this is exactly what they do. Jewish humor is extremely witty and always has a profound political, sociological role. And this is what it is. This is exactly what this unit 8200 did. His unit owned the most brutal victims. When this happened, there was no way we could criticize them any longer. They say, yeah, we know. We are criminals. For you to say, you are a criminal. And I tell you, yeah, we are. Brother, they are clever. But and yet, their tricks must be exposed. And the reason that I get so much flack, used to get anyway, is because I'm from there. I am, family wise, blah blah blah. I understand them because I'm from there.
Yeah, you're from Israel too, for people who don't know.
I'm from Israel, and and I have my rabbis in the past, and I didn't even know, I knew about Tzipi Livni, but obviously. She's a relative of mine, but the other day in America I met Christopher Oberlin, and he came to me to talk to me about Menachem Atzmon. Do you know who he is?
Say that again.
Menachem Atzmon, Manny Atzmon, or Menachem Atzmon. It was interesting. No, obviously, I'm obviously, for the obvious reasons, I'm not touched with my family. But he was the guy. I wasn't even aware of it because my study of 9/11 is limited. He was the guy, the director of the company of all those security. He's a Israeli, very rich guy, and was the front guy for Shaul Eisenberg, who was a weapon dealer. Mm-hmm. He was the guy who was the CEO, if I get it right, of those companies that were taking care of the security security measures in airports in Northern America in September 11th. So yeah, I've
they run the CCTV cameras. that group, but the reinsurance company was Comptroller and Fitzgerald, which one of the planes hitting the towers, but whatever.
Yeah, you know, you can ask Chris. You know, it was shocking for me to see that Christopher knew actually every dangerous element in my family. He came right into the meeting. He knew me better than me. You know, he's a good researcher. You know, there are some of those. You know, it's thanks God for that. I understand it because I'm from there, and but I must tell you something. You know, I was very lucky to become a saxophonist. You know, because if I wouldn't, I could have end up in this as they are. You know, this is something that you know, when you are clever. Well, they would usually look after you to a certain extent to get some stuff, to get some mileage out of your brain. You know,
I think part of that does go back to the religion, though. I mean, the story of Jacob and Esau, like, Jacob is praised as a character who basically tricks and lies and fools everybody around him. And yet that's seen as virtuous because the cleverness of the lie is seen as this good thing. Whereas when Christianity comes along, they place virtue in honesty. It doesn't, you don't have to be clever to be honest. Anybody can be honest.
You are right. I just recently read an interesting book called The Chosen. It's a new book. It's an American research. And you know, it was a book. It could be summed up into a single paragraph. And now it with your listeners. It's basically it argues that the power of the Jews has something to do with their literacy and early literacy. It's actually an interesting read, you know, for 30 pages, you know, following the destruction of the Second Temple, the way Jews went in Palestine, the first century went through a cultural revolution, and in order to be a Jew, to consider yourself as a Jew, hating your son, make him literate in Hebrew and Aramaic, was compulsory. This led towards a sharp decrease in the numbers of Jews in Palestine. I think that they dropped from either worldwide or whatever. Just in Palestine, I don't remember the details, from 5 million to less than 1 million. It is very, very interesting. But this was already, in terms of cognitive elite, it created a form of elitism. Now, what we don't understand is that most Jews who were peasant at the time couldn't afford to send their kids to educate. And the outcome was that they were left out, and then Christianity, as well as other sects, I wasn't even aware of this sect called the Evionim, offered the Jews, those Jews who were left out, to be again part of the community of a new culture that maintain the Judaism, monotheism, but gave them a lot of exemptions. You know, you didn't have to send your kid, you didn't have to circumcise your son, you know, it became very cheap, and it became eventually the dominant culture. So it is quite interesting. There is definitely something in the Jewish culture that set Israelism, Jewish cognitive elite domination in America, or at least let's talk about gross overrepresentation. And it is the fact that we are not allowed to talk about it is in itself very, very revealing.
Yeah, that's the Voltaire quote, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's 1 hour exactly. It was an interesting discussion. Always like talking to you, Gilad, and I hope you can come back to Japan soon, man.
Yeah, I have some offers. I'm launching an album here, and I have to make sure that I'm setting it right. So I probably come toward the summer.
Okay.
I just got there. Great to talk to you. I'm sorry in the beginning I was slightly, I'm always very slow in the beginning.
On a roll, you know.
Nice to talk to you, brother. Let me know once you publish it.
All right. Take care. Yeah, probably in a couple of days. See you, man.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
I don't know how much of it's really cognitive elite or not. I hate the term elite. Maybe so, but the way I see it is just nothing more than a group which has ingrained itself in the state, which adopts them because the group is highly prejudiced and thus ripe for fostering conflicts for the military-industrial conflict to profit from. They're not so clever or smart, they just have overlapping interests with the war machine, which is the giant corporate conglomerate that took over the United States post-World War II. As the military became more and more mechanized, it ended up becoming a billion and then trillion dollar industry. And you have this group of elitist Jewish supremacists who get tons of foreign aid from the government, just as the Wahhabis and other religious fanatics do, because they're good for business. They're about as intellectually superior as the Saudi royals are, who just have money because they already have money from the monarchy and the system set up by religion since ancient times, and they haven't been able to overthrow that system because of the scientifically superior Western society, which props them up and protects them from overthrow. Hollywood is there to sell the war. It started with dehumanizing Indians and later Arabs. They happen to be sitting on a vital resource, and I don't really see this as a contest of who's clever, just more or less who is the most immoral. And that happens to be the religious groups which foster prejudice and supremacy. There are a lot of Christian Zionists that support it ideologically because it's basically just a numbers game. There are a lot more of them, and so the probability of these people getting in positions of power are high, and it's not because they're clever or smart or superior in any way, other than they're just being a vast pool of people and suckers that believe in that. And thus, it's just a numbers game. We don't have a lot of scientists and engineers, etc., involved in politics. Democracy is the product of the lowest common denominator and low information voter, and it begets the system that it does, which is very predictable. A group with ethnic nepotism and racism over time will take over industries because once a member of that supremacist group is in power, there's no reversal because they only hire each other and exclude everyone else from the industry. There's nothing clever about that, too. It's just, again, who's the most evil, immoral, and maniacal. However, what Gilad said, giving the example of Detroit, is true. They're not going and fishing out the best and brightest from American cities. However, I don't think they're very interested in forwarding progress as a whole. They're just wanting to keep the status quo and their own families sitting on top where they are. I have my own thoughts on why the bell curve is the way it is too, but that's a discussion for another time. I wish Gilad and I had more time because this is a discussion I'd really like to continue.